Okay, let's get started, please. Firstly, are there any questions from last week's material? No immediate questions? Okay. So a couple of admin things to start off with. This week I provided handouts. So last year, if I remember right, I didn't provide handouts. We're kind of moving to doing things electronically. Many of you now bring laptops or pads or something to lectures, so we don't need handouts. But then again, some people find handouts useful. So can I just have a show of hands? Can you please put up your hand if you really would like me to provide you with paper copies of lecture notes before each lecture with the slides? Okay, so I will do that from now on. So you, at the back of the room, you've got this week's slides, and at each lecture from now on, when there's some new slides available, I'll have them at the lecture as well. All right, the next admin topic is tutorials. So the numbers registered for this course seem to be going up and down quite a bit, so we're still in the process of finalizing who is in which tutorial group, and indeed, too, of figuring out who's going to be teaching them. But from your point of view, what matters is the tutorial group you saw yourself in last week may not be the final tutorial group you're in. So please check through this week if you get moved. And if you get moved to a time that's not suitable, then certainly get in contact with the second year course secretary, Kendall Reed, who should have emailed you about the tutorial groups, and check with her. Let her know that move actually doesn't work with me. Could you give me this other time? And somehow, by the end of this week, start of next week, when tutorials actually start, hopefully we'll have you all sorted out with a time that works for you, and also time that kind of works for the team of tutors that we're putting in place as well. So that's tutorials. Also, to prepare for tutorials, there is a tutorial sheet of questions, of I think 4 or 5 questions, and I put that up on the web this morning. So if you go to the schedule page linked to from the home page of the course, you'll find listed there for week 3 in a column for tutorials, you'll find a link to this sheet. So please have a look at that this week in preparation for next week. It's really important to come to tutorials prepared rather than just turning up and expecting to learn something. If you do just turn up without having prepared, you won't learn nearly as much, and your tutor's likely to get a bit angry with you as well. So please prepare for tutorials. It's really in your interests in the end. You'll get much more out of the tutorials if you're ready coming with questions, coming with some understanding and pointers to those issues which you're wanting clarification on. All right, on to the fun stuff. So last week I was just finishing off last couple of slides when we were talking about data representation. And so I wanted to just do those slides now, and then we'll move on to the main topic of this week, which is the one of the handout you received, which is assembly language programming. All right, so last week we were looking at different ways of representing using bits and binary numbers, common data types that you want to work with when you're programming. So we looked at representing signed and unsigned integers, and then we started talking about floating point, and we got up to this slide here, which was just showing the details of how you translate between floating point numbers in one of these IEEE standard formats. I translate between the numbers themselves and the representation as a sequence of ones and zeros. So if you remember, there's this idea of, say, if we take the format for floating point numbers represented using 32 bits, we take a 32-bit word like this, and we split it into 3 parts, a sign part, an exponent part, and a significand part, and we treat this field as denoting an unsigned number integer in the standard way. And this part here is a sequence of ones and zeros we treat as a binary fraction. So So this is a sequence of ones and zeros, which when we look at the number, are placed after a binary point being the binary equivalent of a decimal point. So when we've got a number represented using these three fields, which we can call S, exp, and sig, then the corresponding number looks like this. And so the sig is just the bits after this binary point here, and the exp field is an unsigned number, but then we subtract, it's 8 bits, so it's between 0 and 255, and we subtract 127 from it to get an actual exponent for the number 2. So if the maximum is 255, then you've got 255 minus 1 to 27 is the maximum value you can have here. Actually, it was asked afterwards, there are some special exceptions. When you actually come to look at the details of the format, you find when the exponent is all ones, which is the highest value, and all zeros, which is the lowest value, there are special meanings to that 32-bit string. So if you put all zeros for the exponent, and indeed actually also all zeros for the significand, then that's the way in which you represent the number zero. If you've got all ones here, then different codes over here in the significand field give you representations of plus and minus infinity, or an error has occurred. For example, if you've tried to divide by zero, there's a special code for the result of such a division. And yeah, here was an example of translating one way, going from 3/4 0.75 base 10 into a binary representation as a fixed point number, fixed point binary number, to a kind of floating point scientific format where you've got one point something and then two to some exponent. And then we see it translated actually to a sequence of bits, zero for the sign because it's positive. This here is, I think, 126. So you subtract off 127 to get minus 1. So this is the x field. You've got x, the power of 2 is x minus 127. And then this here is the bit after the binary point, and it's just a 1 followed by all zeros. So here we see going one way, and you should easily be able to go the other way as well. And in that tutorial sheet I just mentioned a few minutes ago, there were some examples for you to work through going both ways. This was for 32 bits, and for 64 bits, when you use 64-bit words for double precision floating point numbers, you have different sizes for the exponent field and the significand field. And these happen to be the numbers that are used in the IEEE format. All right, and then finishing off talking about floating point numbers. And then the third basic data type that that I'd like to tell you about is characters or strings. So characters need to be coded in binary. Usually we're not kind of adding and multiplying characters together. So we're not worried so much about efficiencies of different representation. We just care about the fact that we've got a family of different codes, different numbers, which can be used to represent different characters. A very common representation is ASCII. It's a kind of quite old one. Here, originally this is 7 bits. These days it's an 8-bit code. So with 7 bits, they could code 128 characters, 8 bits, a few more. And here are some examples expressed as hexadecimal numbers. So the character 0 is actually the written out in hex. It's 30. The character capital A is hex 41, and the little a is hex 61. This is just some examples of ASCII. Java uses a 16-bit coding scheme. So in Java, you can talk about a much, much wider range of characters from lots of different languages. So once you've got a way of representing characters, then a word or a sentence or a book can just be represented as a stream, as a sequence of a finite sequence of characters or strings, as we call them commonly in computer science. When you're using just sequences of characters or arrays of characters to represent strings, there are two conventions for how you designate the end of a string. One is you have a special character which always appears in the end. This is what happens in the C language, for example, and you use what's called the null character, which has got all zeros. If you're working with Java, in Java, they'll use a pair of an array and a separate number which records the number of characters actually in that string. And so they're isomorphic, you achieve the same result, but they have different computational properties. So for example, if you hold the length of a string explicitly as in a separate part of the string data structure, then it's very quick to find out the length of the string. You just look at the value in that field. If you've got a string in C, you have to start from the beginning and work one by one down the whole string to find the end character, to then count the number of characters in that string. So if you've got a string which is, 500,000 characters long, just calculating its length is a bit of a hassle, and it's not something you can do efficiently. All right, any questions on that? No? Good. All right, let's move on. So that was finishing up last week, and this week we're going to start talking about assembly language programming. So what we're going to be looking at today, and also on Friday this week, is the actual language that, or an example of a language that processors actually understand. So you've been exposed to Haskell and Java, but these are high-level languages. These languages are not the languages that actual physical hardware understands. So we'll be looking at a simple, popular example of a native processor language. And a big kind of general theme of this whole course is looking at how the world of software that you work in as a software engineer, how that world interfaces with the world of the physical electronic hardware. And you can view this interface on different levels. Perhaps the interface is that to a library of subroutines. Perhaps it's an interface to an operating system. But in some sense, the interface that you've got to the hardware provided by the actual language of the CPU, that's a kind of very basic level, very basic interface. And it shares properties of other interfaces too. So hopefully, when you did Java, did you get onto interfaces? Yes. So an interface is a very powerful software engineering paradigm which pops up in many different guises. So the idea of an interface is to hide detail and present the user with a very clean view of what's below that then they can work with very efficiently. And so that happens with CPUs as well, that you're presented with a set of instructions that the CPU, the central processing unit, understands. But actually the way in which it works can be infinitely more complicated than actually what you see. But you're not exposed to that detail. You can still work with it using a simplified model in a very effective manner. So this instruction, this native language itself is not the kind of end of the story as far as what the hardware is actually doing, but it provides an interface to the hardware which has a uniformity and enables you to work effectively in creating programs. We're going to be looking at a particular assembly language and called MIPS. This is it stands for microprocessor without interlocked pipeline stages. You'll find out later what this word pipelined means. Let's not worry about what the acronym means right now. And if you want to read about it, and you'll want to do that shortly, there's an appendix to the textbook for the course, which is online, and the URL is given right here. So if you'd want to kind of see the details, see kind of laid out information about the MIPS language, then go there. All right, so we'll be talking about the instructions that a CPU understands. We'll be looking a bit about looking at the essence of the hardware structure of a CPU, very simplified model of the hardware, and then kind of looking at different classes of instructions, so instructions for arithmetic, instructions for transferring data between memory and the CPU, instructions for implementing things like while loops and if-then statements, if-then-else statements that you write in high-level languages. And then finally method calls, so how you start implementing calls to methods or functions and returns from those that you frequently use in high-level languages. That's where we're going. All right, so we talk about an instruction set. So the collection of all machine instructions recognized by a particular processor, rather really we should say a family of processors. So we talk about the ARM instruction set for these embedded ARM processors. We talk about the x86 processor, which is probably the processor in most of your laptops. There are other popular ones as well. So I already gave you a little talk about this notion of an interface, this notion of how the instruction set actually abstracts away from a lot of details. Another term combined with the instruction set is what we call the instruction set architecture. So this is a programmer's view of what's inside the CPU. So for example, for the MIPS CPU, the kind of picture that that we're going to work with is a very simple picture. So we're going to have MIPS CPU and memory. And so this could be your megabytes or gigabytes of, let's just say, physical memory for the time being. So memory and actual chips inside your computer. So it could be megabytes or gigabytes. And then for the MIPS CPU, the kind of programmer viewpoint of this is that it contains a small number of data registers. In the MIPS architecture, there are 32 registers, and each one is 32 bits. Well, there's a slide that talks about them a couple of slides down, but this is kind of the essence of the start of the instruction set architecture for a MIPS CPU. It's just a box which can do fancy things with data, but internally it's got a bit of memory, which we call registers, and then the CPU talks to the kind of memory outside the CPU, and this memory here is many orders of magnitude larger than this register storage inside the CPU. So when we talk about instruction set architecture, we're abstracting from particular implementations. For something like the x86 architecture, over the years there are literally hundreds of implementations of that architecture. But from a programmer's point of view, those implementation details largely don't matter. Sometimes, obviously, as processors, as a manufacturer releases new processors, they'll be tempted to add new instructions, add new fancy features. But there'll be a core set of instructions and a core model of how the CPU looks, say in terms of how its registers looks, which is going to stay constant. And so that's what we mean by an instruction set architecture or an ISA. Right, the different kinds of CPUs. This slide, I want to talk about a historic big distinction that's been made. And it's the distinction between what we now call RISC computers, this is reduced instruction set computers, and complex instruction set computers. So fairly early on, people got in the spirit of making this assembly, this basic language that the CPU understands, quite rich and complicated to provide the programmer with more facilities to easily, in a small space of code, write what they wanted to write. Over time, though, people stopped programming in assembly language, so it really became irrelevant what language the CPU actually understood. And the designers of CPU started banging their heads against walls because they said, look, all this complexity is just making our life more difficult. We would like to just work with simpler instructions, which are then, of course, automatically provided by a compiler. A human never actually has to write that stuff. And if we can work with a simpler set of instructions, or a reduced set of instructions, hence RISC, we'll be able to design a leaner, faster, smaller, more energy efficient architecture. So this is, for example, that this is why the x86 architecture, which is used in laptops, was one of the reasons why it wasn't the architecture that got that caught on for handheld devices, why the ARM architecture caught on, because the ARM architecture, for example, was a RISC architecture, whereas the x86 architecture used in from Intel used in desktops and laptops is a CISC, a complex instruction set architecture. And indeed, funnily enough, what you've seen happen even with Intel is internally inside their CPUs, every time a complex instruction is given to that CPU, internally it translates it into a sequence of simpler RISC-like instructions, just because handling that one complex instruction, as I said, is just too much of a headache. So on the fly within the CPU, it's doing a degree of translation just to maintain that external viewpoint of a complex instruction set and to kind of support all the legacy code out there that's still relying on that complex instruction set. Down the bottom here, I've got an example, just one example trying to show you a bit about the difference. So assume in Java or C, you did an assignment like this. You had some variables A and B, and you just said A equals B plus 10. How would you implement this in a RISC architecture? That would actually be implemented using three instructions. A load word, so R2 would be, let's see, do I want to go into all the detail? R2 would be where B is held. That would be, so the R's are all names of registers inside the CPU. So we'd be taking R2 would actually be the address in memory of where B is held. So this is reading the data at the address in R2 into R4, so R4 is some temporary storage. Here we're adding the value in R4 to 10 and storing that in R5. And here we're taking the value in R5 and we're storing it at the address given by register R3. So register R3 is holding the address of A. So we're breaking down that addition into three discrete steps. Whereas in the CISC architecture, we could accomplish the same just using a single instruction. So this is an example of what I mean by here we've got some simpler steps. Here in a complex instruction set architecture, we've got one more complicated step. I started using, I think I maybe use this phrase assembly language, but I'll certainly use it now. So when we actually look at the nature of one of these languages that a CPU understands, then these individual instructions are made up of bytes or words of data, so binary numbers. And if we're wanting, as humans, to program in assembly language, we do not want to be writing down ones and zeros. That's terribly error-prone, and it's incomprehensible as well. So what people quickly did was they invented a language which kind of captures the structure of instructions. So actually, those instructions I showed you before are examples of assembly language instructions. So they're not telling you the ones and zeros, but there's a very direct translation from those assembly language statements into actually words of ones and zeros, which then the hardware itself can understand. And as I said, yes, so for this course, the example instruction set we're going to work with is this MIPS one. Let's move on to one class of instructions that you find in the MIPS architecture. And indeed, in every architecture, you'll find instructions which do this kind of thing. So here we see a couple of few examples of instructions for doing arithmetic and doing logical operations. So here, on the left, we see an example of an assembly language statement, a MIPS one. A, B, and C are all names of registers inside the CPU. So these, they're actually numbers between, each of them is a number between 0 and 31, talking about one of these registers inside the CPU. And the first argument, the A, is the place you can put the data after you've done the operation. And then the B and C are the two arguments to the operation, at least for these first two, which are binary operations. So add A comma B comma C says take the values out of registers B and C, add them together, and store the result into register A. Sub ABC says, again, take the values out of B and C, and then store B minus C, the value in register B minus the value in register C, store that value into register A. Just like these operations, we have what we call bitwise logical operations, things like AND or exclusive OR. Anybody who's not quite sure what bitwise means? Everybody knows what bitwise. So bitwise just means you operate on corresponding bits. So bit zero of the first, if you're doing an AND, you probably do this in Java, but you certainly do it in C. So bitwise means if you've got two words like A and B, and you're doing an AND of them, and it's a bitwise one, then that just means so the AND of these two equals this, then we're taking bit zero from here, ANDing it with bit zero here, and that's giving us bit zero there. Taking bit one here, ANDing it with bit one there, and that's giving us bit one down there. So that's what bitwise means. So for AND, OR, everybody knows what exclusive OR is? Anybody want the truth table? Okay, you all know what exclusive OR is, good. So exclusive OR, just to say, just in case there's anybody shy, exclusive OR is like OR. This truth table is, we'll actually see this later, but I'll just show you anyway. Truth table looks like that. So when either A or B is a logic 1, A or B, A exclusive or B is logic 1, but it's exclusive, so if both of them are 1, then A or B is 0. So A exclusive or B is 0. So that's exclusive OR. Shift instructions, so we talked a bit about shifting before. So SLL stands for shift left logical. Shifting, yeah, so this is, you've got a word, it's got some data in it, and when you shift the left, all the data kind of gets moved along. What's on the end here just gets lost, and what gets fed in is a zero. We've then got the shift right operations, which are shifting the opposite direction. And if you remember, so here, say we go upwards shifting right. We shift right. When we do that, we lose what's on the right-hand end. And there's a question of what we feed in here. One operation, which is shift right logical, this one we see here, is to shift in zeros. The other operation, shift right arithmetical, is when we sign extend whatever's here. So if there's a 1 here, we always just feed in 1s. If there's a 0 here, and as we shift right, we feed in 0s. And you remember from last week why we do that, all to do with signed arithmetic. This corresponds, this gives us nice arithmetic properties for what shifting right corresponds to. On the right-hand side, then we see here kind of how we lay out the arguments. So here, A is where the result of the shift goes, B is where you take the data from, and SHAMT stands for shift amount. It's a number between 0 and 31, which says how many positions to the right or to the left you actually want to do that shift. So you're not just restricted to shifting one place, but you can choose the number of places, right or left, you shift in a single instruction. And what we see over here is notation I don't know if all of you would have seen before, because you don't do this as often in Java, but this is actually the C notation for doing shifts. So B double less than some number between 0 and 31 will shift B left, do a logical shift left on B by that amount. This here will do a logical shift right of B by whatever number you put in here. All right, so we've got, so these are kind of basic operations on data, and these particular ones are always taking data from registers and putting them back into some register that you indicate in the instruction. Here's a slide that talks a bit more about registers. So the main point about this, I guess there are kind of two issues in the slide, sort of covered them already, and the kind of principal one is one of these simplifying steps that was made with the RISC architectures was they said that all these arithmetic operations should only be between registers, and the transfer of data between memory, from memory to registers or from registers to memory, that always should be accomplished by separate instructions. Typically, yes, as it says there, the size of registers equals the size of the memory word. So if you've got a 32-bit architecture, typically the internal registers are also 32 bits. So the MIPS architecture is a 32-bit architecture, and so we have 32-bit registers here as well. And yes, I've kind of said in the last bullet, I made that point already. You've got a few registers, 32 in the MIPS case, and it's really for local storage of program variables, those variables which the CPU is going to be using most frequently. So when a compiler is compiling code, it always has an idea of kind of which variables are the active ones, which ones are you wanting to do operations on. And then it will choose to store those variables in the registers. But then as the program executes on, different sets of variables become live and become the important ones. And then the program, the compiler, will figure out, well, now I'll store those variables that I'm not using as much now out into memory, and I'll pull some other variables into my registers so I can work on them quickly now. Sometimes different registers have different purposes. Generally, in the MIPS architecture, most of the registers, or the use of most registers, is interchangeable. There are some conventions that are adopted, and we'll see those conventions actually on this slide even. So the conventions adopted, which can just ease portability of code. So this is when different people write assembly language code, if they follow these conventions, then it's just that much easier to make their code work together. Here we see for some register names which are now specific to MIPS. So in MIPS, they give registers names that start with a dollar sign, and then have a letter, and then have a number. So the variables, the registers called $S0 up to $S7, these are ones used for holding the values of program variables, say in your C or the Java program that's been compiled down to assembly code, to machine code. There's another set of 10 variables, or 10 registers in this register file, which are used for very temporary storage, local storage, internal storage within your assembly language program. One register, register 0, which actually has got special name $0, is actually always hardwired to have the value 0. And this just simplifies then the assembly language or the number of instructions the CPU has to understand. So for example, say the effect you want to achieve is to move a value from one register and store it into another register. Given what I've told you already, what instructions have you seen would be useful for doing this, knowing that we always have number zero in register zero. Add. Yes, so if we want to achieve a move, all we do is we take the value, say, in this register, and we just add to it the value in register zero and store the result here. And that will achieve the effect of just moving. So we don't need, so even though actually you'll see later in the assembly language, we can write MOV or MOVE for move, it'll actually translate that into an add instruction. So we've designed our architecture to try to keep down as much as possible the number of distinct instructions that have to be implemented by the hardware. And this means the hardware can be smaller and leaner and faster. There's some other registers too which have special roles, and we'll come to those shortly today or on Friday. Distinct from the data registers is a special register called the program counter. So the PC is a separate register, we call it register as well, because we call these the data registers. The program counter itself is a register, and it always holds the address of the next instruction in the memory that we're going to execute. So when we've finished executing one instruction, we look at where the PC is pointing to figure out where to pull the ones and zeros for the next instruction that the CPU will handle. Let's move on through the families of instructions, what are called, look at a family called the immediate instructions. So when we talk about immediate instructions, the idea here is that the instruction itself holds part of the data for the instruction. This data that's there in the instruction is called the immediate data, or sometimes an immediate operand, a thing that is being operated on by the instruction. One example is at the top here with add I. So this is add immediate. And it takes names of just two registers, not three. But then as a third argument, it takes a number. This happens to be a 16-bit signed number. So if we want to add a small positive or negative quantity to the value in one register and store it in another, this is the instruction that we should be using. Given what I told you about zero, if you just want to put a small value, a small constant into a register, you can just add zero to do an add immediate with this register $0 here. So the effect of this is shown in the comment here. So comments in this assembly language are always after hash signs or pound signs. And so this is saying registers S0 gets the value of this immediate argument N. And more specifically, bits. So this is how we talk about subsequences of bits of registers. So here we mean bits 15 through 0. So if you remember, so the convention we're adopting, certainly for this course, is that bits are always numbered with the most significant bit being bit 31 and the least significant bit being bit 0. So the bits 15 through 0 are the 16 less significant bits of a 32-bit word, and bits 31 to 16 are the more significant 16 bits. So here we're saying the lower 16 bits get the value of this immediate argument because it is only a 16-bit value. And in this case, the upper 16 bits just get the value 0. So we can write add I. As I was hinting, the assembly language gives us a bit more flexibility. It doesn't insist on us actually writing add I with a zero argument. Instead, we can use what's called a pseudo instruction, like load immediate. So li stands for load immediate, and we can just write the name of one register and then the constant. And then this, I guess as a first step, you can imagine this gets translated into something very much like this, where instead of n, we've got constant there, and reg is this argument, is the register that you can store the constant value into. And indeed, the pseudo instruction compiler will be a little bit more clever than that. So if you give it a constant which is expressible using 16 bits or less, it'll just translate that to be a single instruction. If you give it a constant bigger than that, it'll do something slightly different. It actually will generate two instructions. And we see down the bottom of this slide an example of what would happen. There's an instruction here which is load upper immediate. And so what this does is it takes a 16-bit number which is supplied with the instruction and stuffs it into the upper 16 bits of the register S1 in this case, and it just sets the lower 16 bits to zero. So if we do that, and then we use an instruction called OR immediate, then what we can do is we can OR the immediate value N2 into the word that's already in S1. And the effect of that is to pull N2 into the lower 16 bits, that's here, and we leave the upper 16 bits alone, because zero ORed with anything is just that anything. So when we're doing the OR operation, those upper 16 bits just stay the same. They stay the same as what they were loaded to by the load upper immediate. I see a couple of puzzled faces. Is that clear? Would you like me to expand on that? Perhaps draw a picture on the board. Show of hands for a picture. So there are a few of you who... All right. So... The first instruction is a load upper immediate. So we start with... We've got this register here. And we do a load upper immediate register with N1. So that's going to put N1 up here. So we start with this. Say this is how our register is going to look. Let me do it like this. So initially, we don't know what's inside the register. We execute this instruction, and we end up with a word which looks like the following. There's all zeros in the lower 16 bits, and the number N1 has been put into the upper 16 bits. We then execute the instruction OR immediate with N2, and and we're going to put the value back in the same register R, and we're going to put N2. So what we're going to do is we're going to take the value in the register R, and we're going to OR this with essentially we're going to do the OR of this with this. And when we do an OR operation, every bit of this is zero, so zero ORed with one bit of N2 is just that bit of N2. So the effect is just to copy every bit of N2 down here, and likewise here, we're ORing each bit of N1, again just with a zero. So we're just copying down the bits of N1 to here. So the result we end up with is N1 there, and N2 there. So we've achieved the effect in two instructions of loading some 32-bit number into this 32-bit register. Does that help? Does that make more sense now? Yes? maybe? Questions? I'm going to assume silence is assent, that's helped a bit. Let's move on. All right, a bit more about storing data, how we... now starting to get onto the topic of how we get data from memory into the CPU and how we represent data in the memory. So imagine we've got a Java class up the top there. It's got two fields, both integer fields. Let's assume these are 32-bit. Well, not assume in Java, they are 32-bit integers, and we assume they're laid out consecutively in memory. So over here, we've got a picture of memory. Whenever you see a picture of memory, sometimes these pictures have these addresses here. Sometimes the addresses go up. Sometimes go up as you go down. Sometimes they go up as you go up. Every picture you'll see in a textbook is different. And this is a picture, although memory in some sense is organized as a sequence of bytes, here we're showing kind of one row for each 32-bit word, but the addresses are still in bytes, so that's why we go 0, 4, 8. So we assume we've just executed this constructor here, and we're storing some, we're holding a reference to that newly created object in this variable called myobj. And so in an assembly language or a machine code implementation, we imagine myobj, so it's a reference, so really that's an address. That address is being held in register S2. So the address of S2, we can imagine the value in register S2 kind of points to, indicates an actual address in memory, and it's an address where the data is held. And so we'll imagine at the address S2 is the value of the field var1, and then in the next word is the value of field var2. So we've got some data in memory, and now somewhere we execute instruction that says make the value of variable temp equal to the value stored in the field var2 of this object. And down here we see a load word instruction which would actually be used for this. So we imagine temp now, a program variable, is stored in the register called T1. So this is a load word instruction. It says load data into register T1, representing temp, as I said. And then it tells us where to get the data. It says, look at the value in register S2. So this is the value, this is the address in myobj. Go out into, add the value 4 to it. This is called an offset. Unfortunately, it doesn't say plus, but just the syntax. The syntax is you take the value in this register and you add this offset to that value, and then use that address as the address you're going to fetch the data from. So remember, var2 is actually not where S2 points to. S2 itself, the value in register S2 points to, is the address of var1. Var2 is the next word up the memory. So that's why we add 4 to the value in the register S2 to get the address of var2, and then we fetch data from that address. That's shown in this comment here. This comment's imagining memory to be an array of words. And so here's the index to the array. The index is 4 plus the value in register S2. We use that index, we fetch the data in memory at that address, and we store it into the variable, into the register called T1. So we started to seeing here both an example of a load word instruction in action, and we're seeing examples, starting to see how a language you're familiar with might be translated into assembly language and then eventually machine code. Here's a table which summarizes various kind of simple family of load and store instructions. So just as you can load data from a memory location, load a word from memory into some register, perhaps adding an offset to the address of the data first, you can store, you can do the opposite. You can take the value from a register and store it out into memory. So here we're seeing the effect here. At the address R2 plus this offset value, we can store the data which is held in register R1. We can normally work with words. Sometimes you can work with bytes as well. There's a load byte instruction which only sets the only reads a single byte from memory rather than a whole word, and then sign extends that byte. There's an instruction I didn't show you which won't do the sign extension, LBU, load byte unsigned, and that instruction always sets the upper 24 bits to a zero. And there's a store byte instruction as well. So here we it just takes the byte at the bottom of the word, the byte in the eight least significant bits of the word, and it stores that byte out into memory at the address specified by the value in register R2 plus this offset N. All right, I've got two more slides to do, but I'm going to stop there because we're out of time now. And we'll resume from slide 12 next time. One thing I should say to you right now is if you go to the schedule page for the course, you will find there not only a link to the tutorial, but a link to a lab. So there's a lab on a simulator for the MIPS architecture. And you can really, given what you've seen now, you could start doing that lab. And I recommend that because that lab then feeds into the first practical for this course, which will be out in a week or two's time. Thank you.
R2, we use the offset. Couldn't we just directly access the R2 as, I don't know, S3 or something?
You don't have, you can set the offset to zero, in which case the register S2 just gives you the address of the data where you're loading things from.
Wasn't the R2 in any way also signed as some other variable in the class?
So if you go back to the slide here, so the point is with VAR2 is not a program variable. It's an object. It's an object with two fields. And when we talk about an object, we just talk about an object of where the storage for that object starts. And so some data is at the address of R1, but some data kind of follows on from that address. It's at higher addresses. And so this ability to talk about offsets was kind of put in there because they knew people program with objects and structures in C, which are like objects, all the time. So you have this need to be able to talk very quickly about data which is just a bit beyond the start of the object.
But S2 is a register?
S2 is a register itself, which holds the address of the object. So it's the register which is holding the value of this program variable at this point in time here.
Okay. So the S2 will hold everything for the class, I mean, or...
S2 just holds the address of this one object of the class. But if you've got many objects, each one will be at a different address.
Because
are you in here now?
Yes. And what is the... Is there a maximum length? For example, how many variables can be in that?
These offsets usually can be up to 16 bits. Sorry, are you lecturing now?
Yes.
Yeah, okay, I'll be right out.
My director studies.
Just thinking, this is really a useful subject.
All subjects are useful in different ways. Let's get out of here.
Can I ask one question?
Is the microphone?
I was just using it. It's charged, so.
Okay. What do you press to work?
Let me show you. So it's now off because you see nothing there. You kind of squeeze here and lift up.
Right, okay.
And you press that and you hold that until the display comes on.
Okay, thanks.
And then when it's on, there's this button here called mute.
Okay. Mm-hmm.
And when it's that way, then it's muted and you can talk and nothing happens.
Right,
you switch it, that way
mm-hmm.
and it comes on and you can use it.
Mm-hmm.
So that way you can kind of clip it on and so on with it muted.
Okay.
And then just the last second you can click it.
Okay, thank you very much.
Mute.
Yeah, that's very
and then when you're finished, you just
uh-huh.
drop it back and it
charges
it there.
Uh-huh.
All right, get rid of my memory stick here. Right, over to you. Okay, so you had a question.
Yeah. What MOV